If you want to get your Bibles and turn to John chapter 19, we'll be continuing our study there this morning. There are some handouts on the table in the back. If you want to get one of those for the class this morning, if you're coming in and want to grab one on your way in. John chapter 19 is one of those chapters that is somewhat difficult for us to read and difficult for us to fathom all that Jesus endured on our behalf. So I want us to take some time this morning to look at this chapter and try to go through it in similar fashion as we have looked at other chapters, but try to have a greater understanding and a deeper appreciation for all that Jesus did on our behalf. There's just two things I want us to see, just some vital concepts, but we're going to spend most of our time looking at the theme of this chapter this morning. But just very quickly, I want us to point out and recognize that when you read John chapter 19, we need to understand that Jesus truly was dead on that cross. He really did die. There are some who have tried to advance some kind of theory that Jesus merely collapsed, he swooned, he became unconscious, but that he really didn't die. And once they placed him in the tomb and he revived, he woke up and he came out. But I want you to think about all that's revealed in John 19. And I've limited our study to this chapter, although we could include many other thoughts that come from other passages in the New Testament. But the Romans are the ones who had perfected. They hadn't originated crucifixion, but they had certainly perfected, if you want to call it an art, the art of crucifixion. They knew exactly how to torture someone. They knew exactly how to put someone to death, but to make sure that they prolonged the coming of that death as long as possible in order that the torture might be as intense as possible. But if there was anybody who knew what death looked like, it was the Romans. And for sure, the Roman soldiers who were there and their very job was putting people to death. And when they came to Jesus, chapter 19, verse 33 says, they saw that he was already dead. Do you think they knew what death looked like? Here are these Roman soldiers. This was their job. This is what they did every day. They saw that he was dead. And just to make sure, they threw a spear through his side. And out came blood and water. And then John, obviously, is a witness of these things and claims to be a witness of them. In verse 35, do you think Pilate would have allowed Joseph of Arimathea to take his body if he really didn't think he was dead? In fact, when you go over into, Luke's account. If you go over to Luke chapter 31, I think it's Luke's account where when Pilate heard the report that Jesus was dead, he didn't believe it. Surely he can't be dead already. How long was Jesus hanging on the cross? 6 hours. Think about how long that is to be hanging on a cross, to be suspended by nails in your hands and your feet. But 6 hours was actually a short amount of time to be on the cross. We think about it, and we think that's just an unfathomable amount of time to be in that much pain, but 6 hours was actually a very short amount of time, and that's why Pilate was surprised to hear that Jesus was already dead. But that's also why the Jews came along and asked Pilate to have their legs broken so that they could hasten the death. Death usually took a very long time to come on the cross. And the Jews and the Romans treated dead bodies differently. The Romans, for all the Romans cared, they would leave the bodies on the cross not only until they died, but they wouldn't take the bodies off of the cross. They'd let the elements and the beasts take care of the bodies. But of course, the Jews, with their Sabbath the next day and their holy day coming, they did not follow that particular line of thinking, and so they wanted the bodies to come off. And so Joseph of Arimathea at the end of the chapter comes and asks for his body, and he and Nicodemus prepared Jesus' body for burial. So it's an obvious thought, but one that we need to be able to grasp, that John 19 teaches us that there's no question that when Jesus came off of that cross that he was dead. And I think just one other thought before we get to the theme of this chapter. The very idea that Jesus sacrificed himself for us. The very idea that Jesus did not deserve to die. Pilate says, and we'll see this again in just a minute. Look at what Pilate says in verse 4. Brings him out. I'm bringing him out to you that you may know that I find no fault in him. Look down in verse 6. After the mob is crying, crucify him, crucify him. He says, you take him and crucify him. I find no fault in him. Go back up to chapter 18. We looked at this a couple weeks ago. Chapter 18, verse 38, the end of it. Pilate says, I find no fault in him at all. What had Jesus done wrong? What was he guilty of? Nothing. And here's a Roman governor. Doesn't care a thing about Jesus. Really doesn't care a thing about Jewish law. And here's a Roman governor saying, you know, in the little bit of time I've spent with this guy, there's nothing that he has done wrong. And yet Jesus willfully went to the cross to die on our behalf, but not just for us. Jesus died for Pilate. Jesus died for those men who took his arms, stretched them out on that timber, and nailed him to that cross. Jesus died for that mob that kept yelling, crucify him. Jesus died for that soldier that went and found that bush with thorns and twisted that bush, that string of thorns into the shape of a crown and smashed it on his head. The very idea that there was not a single person who was ever deserving of it, but that Jesus sacrificially, voluntarily died on our behalf is just something that is a little too much for us to even comprehend. Let's look at this chapter. And to boil it down, obviously there's different themes that we could identify as a part of this chapter. But let's just look at this and the fact that Jesus endured everything that we read in this chapter. He endured it all for us. Look at this in various categories. Was Pilate was he much of a religious guy? No. Was he sympathetic to the Jewish cause, to the Jewish faith? No, didn't care a thing about it. Here's Pilate. Like many of the politicians of that day, Pilate was corrupt. He wasn't so concerned about making sure that things were done necessarily in a proper way as long as they protected Rome. And as long as they made Rome look good, then it didn't matter how things maybe fell out. And he's not only corrupt, he's a coward. Think about what we learn about Pilate in John chapter 19. First of all, we see this man Pilate, where we've already seen that three times he said, I find no fault in him. But what does verse 1 tell us that he did? He had Jesus scourged. If this guy is innocent, why are you having him beaten and scourged? Scourging oftentimes would take the victim's life. If he's innocent, then why are you having him scourged? If I find no fault in him, and he says it three times, then Pilate, why are you delivering him to be crucified? Why would Pilate, a governor, And in this case, the judge over this matter, why would he condemn an innocent man to death? Richard? Yes, that's true. We don't read about Herod King Herod in John's account. John wrote several decades after Matthew, Mark, and Luke did, and so most of his writing is intended to be supplementary, not a repetition of those things. But you read the other accounts about Herod, and you remember how Pilate sent Jesus to Herod, and then Herod sent Jesus back to Pilate. And before that time, the relationship between Herod and Pilate was not all that great, but somehow Jesus brought Herod and Pilate together. And so Pilate was seeing this and using this occasion to advance and to improve his political standing. And that's all he's concerned about. All he's concerned about is himself. All he's concerned about is not necessarily that things be done right, but that things help him advance politically. Nicole? Yes. Pilate thought, and wrongly thought, but Pilate thought that, you know, if I just have him scourged, perhaps this will take care of it. Perhaps I'll satisfy them. He sees nothing wrong with him. He has him scourged. Look in verse 2. Let's start in verse 2. The soldiers twisted a crown of thorns and they put it on his head. It's interesting when you just read that through. It just sounds so natural. It just sounds, okay, that's just the normal thing that they did. They twisted a crown of thorns. And the word put just sounds like they laid, you know, they just gently, you know, placed it on his head. Anything but. They put on him a purple robe. They said, "Hail, King of the Jews," and they struck him with their hands. Pilate then went out again. Remember that when the Jews brought Jesus to Pilate, that here's these hypocrites, these Jews. Why did they want Jesus to be put to death? What great crime was he guilty of? Oh, nothing. Say again. That's right. This guy made himself out to be the Son of God. So here they are trying to have Jesus put to death for being the Son of God. They're so concerned that Jesus may have violated their law that they've got to have this guy killed. Bunch of hypocrites, because they themselves come to the area of the Praetorium where Pilate was in court, and they themselves would not even come in to that area. Look in chapter 18, verse 28, just as a reminder of this. They led Jesus to Caiaphas, from Caiaphas to the Praetorium, the hall of judgment where Pilate was. It was early morning. They themselves did not go into the Praetorium, lest they should be defiled, but that they might eat the Passover. Oh no, we can't go in there. So here they are in their hypocritical stance. So Pilate has to come out to them. They won't come into Pilate, so he has to go out to them. And so that's what he's doing in verse 4, chapter 19, going out to them again because they wouldn't come in. And he says, "Behold, I am bringing him out to you that you may know that I find no fault in him." Jesus came out. Pilate said, "Behold the man." Pilate thought that by having Jesus scourged and then in this state of humiliation before them, that perhaps this would appease them and they would say, "Okay, that's enough." Did that happen? Oh no. Oh no. Not at all. In fact, they turned on Pilate and talked to him and said, "Don't you know that this guy made himself out to be the Son of God?" And to us, we don't understand perhaps that to the Romans, what gods did they worship? Huh? A bunch. Okay. So here they are. They have as one of their traditions. They have as one of their ideas that if you lived wrong or you acted wrong or you did something out of line, that one of the Roman gods would come down and he would be there to cause you harm. That one of the Roman gods would be sent down to persecute you and cause you a lot of pain in your life. So when the Jews say in verse 8 that he made himself out to be the Son of God, Pilate is not thinking Jehovah. He's not thinking Messiah. He's thinking, oh no, I've got a Roman God on my case. And so he's even more afraid in verse 8 and comes in and says, okay, Jesus, where are you from? But again, he's only concerned about himself in that regard. And then you get into verse 10. And in verse 10, he says, don't you know I have the power to crucify you and the power to release you? What was Pilate going to base his judgment upon? Could Pilate do whatever he wanted to do? That's exactly what he's saying to Jesus. Look, buddy, I've got the power. I can do whatever I want to do in this case. He's not so much concerned about basing anything upon the validity or the truth of the matter, but you know what? I've got the power here. And if you'll say the right thing, I can let you off the hook. But what does Jesus say to him? Hey, buddy, you don't have any power at all unless it's given to you by God. What does that say not only about Pilate, but about all presidents, all kings, all governors, all political leaders? Jesus says in verse 11, you could have no power at all against me unless it had been given you from above. And that's exactly what Romans chapter 13 teaches about civil government. That power that is given, that they have, is given by God, which makes people accountable to God in that regard and how they use that power. And so the Bible says that Pilate continued to try to release Jesus. In verse 12 it says, from then on, Pilate sought, and that's in a continuous action, he continually sought to release Jesus. If you're the governor, if you're the judge, if you're the one who says, I have the power to release you, why not just do it? If you're the one in charge, why is he so weak? I've got the power to release you. Well, then do it. Dirk? Okay. Well, and that's exactly where the Jews went in verse 12. Here he is trying to release him, and the Jews said, hey, if you let this man go, you're not Caesar's friend. Whoever makes himself a king speaks against Caesar. Hey, Pilate, what would happen if we sent a message to Caesar to let him know what was going on here? What if we sent a message to Caesar that said, here's a guy that's claiming to be a king, and Pilate, just let him go? So now who's Pilate concerned about again? Himself. Oh, no. You know, I could get myself in trouble. I could find myself on trial. I could find myself being executed for releasing a king, somebody who had stood up in their minds against the Roman authorities. And so while Pilate was trying to release him, he got concerned that he might be tried for treason. And so he finally succumbed to the pressure that the Jews were bringing on him. And so he says down in verse 14, verse 13 says, he brought Jesus out again. Verse 13 says, when he heard that saying, he brought Jesus out, sat him down, and sat down, didn't sit Jesus down, but Pilate sat down in the judgment seat in a place called the pavement, but in Hebrew, Gabbatha. There was a temporary judgment seat set up outside because the Jews wouldn't come in, so they set up this temporary judgment seat outside at this location. It was the preparation day of the Passover, verse 14. What day is the Passover? What day is, let me ask it this way, what day is the Sabbath day? Saturday. The Passover, how often did the Passover come about? Once a year. Passover was another way of talking about the Feast of Unleavened Bread. And those two feasts, those two occasions occurred at the same time. And so here was a Feast of Unleavened Bread that took place for 7 days. The first day of that feast started on the Sabbath, started on Saturday. And so if this is the preparation day for that feast, it's the day before it, which means this is Friday. And verse 14 says, it's the preparation day of the Passover in about the sixth hour. Now, if you read Matthew, Mark, and Luke, they indicate time, especially Matthew's account, indicates time based upon the Jewish clock. When did the Jews start their clock? When did they start their day? 6 a.m. And so when you read Matthew chapter 27 and about verse 45, where it says that there was darkness on the face, that there was darkness from the sixth hour until the ninth hour, says that they crucified Jesus at the third hour, and then there was darkness from the sixth hour until the ninth hour. That's Matthew writing to Matthew 27, talking about Jewish, basing his time on Jewish, on the Jewish clock that started at 6 a.m. And so if they crucified Jesus at the third hour, what time was that? 9 a.m. If there's darkness from the sixth hour until the ninth hour, what time is that? That's from noon until 3 p.m. In the middle of the day, 3 hours, there was darkness. John is writing several years after the fact. John is writing several years after Judaism and the Jewish nation had been destroyed. In A.D. 70, the Roman armies came through and leveled the city of Jerusalem. Although Jesus had nailed that old law to the cross, in effect, in A.D. 70, in a tangible way, that old Jewish system was brought to an end. John's writing after that has taken place. There's no need for John to base his clock on Jewish time. Who cares? And so when we read through John, he uses the word Jews more than any other writer. John helps us to, he helps to explain some of the Jewish things that were happening, because John's not writing to a Jewish audience as much as some of the earlier Gospels had been. He's writing to a more general audience, including a lot of Gentiles. And so John, anyway, come back to verse 14. He's telling time not based upon Jewish clock, but upon the Roman clock, which is like our clock. They started their day at midnight. And so this was about the sixth hour, and so it was about 6 a.m. Jesus is crucified at 9 a.m., and so here's a time stamp. 6 o'clock in the morning is when Pilate brought Jesus out. Under Roman law, it was, it's interesting, but under Roman law, it was against the law to pronounce a sentence before 6 a.m., so maybe that's why they're telling us the time. 6 a.m., he said to the Jews, in verse 5 he said, "Behold the man." This verse he says, "Behold your king." What's he trying to do? I think he's trying to jab it to them one more time. Here's your king. You think that made them happy? Were they encouraged? Were they uplifted by the fact that, or were they bothered? To say the least. "Behold your king." And they cried out even more in the next. They don't want to hear this idea that Jesus is their king. And so Pilate is going to turn Jesus over to them, but not without a last parting shot to try to bring some shame, some reflection into their lives that you're killing this guy because he says he's your king. So one of the things that we see Jesus enduring in John chapter 19 is a very weak, cowardly, and corrupt governor. But it's not just the governor that he's having to endure. He's enduring a scourging in verse 1. He's enduring a mocking. What did we read in verses 2 and 3? What did they do to Jesus? Why did they twist a crown of thorns? Do you think they did that for everybody they scourged? He said he was a king. If he's a king, what does he need? Oh, he's missing a crown. Let's give him his crown. If he's a king, what else is he missing? Oh, well, he doesn't have a robe. And he needs that royal colored robe. So let's get him a crown. Let's get him a robe. Matthew's account says they put a scepter, a staff in his hand. No doubt is another symbol of a king, but also it would help Jesus hold himself up in his weakened condition. And while John's account does not say that they bowed down, the other accounts do say that they bowed down to him in mock homage and worship, saying, "Hail, King of the Jews." How did Jesus react to this? What did he do? He was led as a lamb to the slaughter. And as a sheep before its shears is dumb, mute, doesn't speak, so he opened not his mouth. Dirk? Yep. The crown of thorns was absolute. Yes. The reed that they put in his hand, the staff they put in his hand, when they stood him up, we whatever you think a scourging is, multiply it by 100. Okay? You know, we think about Paul saying in 2 Corinthians chapter 11 how he was how he received 39 stripes. Well, why did he ever receive 39 stripes? Because when the Jews flogged someone, beat somebody, whipped someone, they had come up and said, "Well, there's 40 stripes is the max. So let's make sure we never go over." And, you know, these Roman soldiers may not be the brightest guys. We don't want them to miscount. So let's stop at 39. Well, that's Jewish tradition. What about Roman tradition? What was their limit on scourging? There was no limit. That Roman legionnaire would step forward with that flagrum, with that whip, with those leather straps coming off of that short handle, with those leather straps that had metal balls, some kind of steel balls, iron balls, some kind of glass, some kind of broken bone, some kind of broken pottery, broken metal, some kind of... you know, when I think about this, I think about those miniature rakes that you use in the garden that have those three prongs that come out. That was part of what they would put on the end of those. This isn't just some kind of a whip you would use on a horse. This is a weapon to inflict as much torture as they possibly can inflict. And the Roman legionnaire, a massive guy, would step forward and he would start bringing that down. Now, what had they done with Jesus? Oh, they take Jesus over and there's this post that's coming out of the ground. Probably a post, because they took him down into an inner room, probably a post that helped support the building. And they stretch Jesus around that post for multiple purposes. One, they tie him to that post and stretch him around because he's about ready to lose consciousness. And it would be very inconvenient if this victim would keep falling down to the ground. We don't want him to keep falling down, so we're going to tie him in such a way that we can continue the beating and not have to keep picking him up. But they also tie him around this post because when you do that, what happens to the skin and the muscles on your back? They're stretched out just perfectly. The Romans knew no mercy. They did not intend to give any mercy. And oftentimes, the victim would die as a result of the scourging. This was not intended to be a light whipping so that they could learn their lesson and don't do that anymore. We're going to let you go, but we're just going to whip you a little bit. Now don't do it again. It was intended to punish. It was intended to torture. It was intended to kill, and it often did. And the fact that Jesus was both scourged and crucified was unheard of. Because oftentimes they wouldn't live through the scourging. But usually it was either or, and not usually was it both. Bill? Yeah. Bill says, you know, Jesus had a purpose for being here, but if it had been anybody else but Jesus, it would have killed him. And if you go back and you read about the Roman scourgings, that's what they did. You cannot, it wasn't just, you know, we read a verse that says, by his stripes we are healed. And when we think stripes, we think about images we've seen on TV or something where someone has been beaten with a whip and they have bruises. They have those red bruises, stripes across their back. That's not what happened. That's not what Jesus' back looked like. When the Romans got done with their scourging, the whole body, not just the back, but his back, his legs, his whole body was an unrecognizable mass of torn and bleeding tissue. They find great joy and gladness in this. Hail, King of the Jews, mocking him to their very best ability. And now back to what Dirk was saying. They had put that reed in his hand, one so he could hold himself up, but another scepter idea, the scepter will not depart out of Judah. That's what a king has. They bowed down, hail, King of the Jews, and then they took that staff from his hand and smacked him over the head with it, yes, while he was wearing the crown of thorns. All of that Jesus endures for us, and then he walks out. What does Jesus look like when Pilate brings him out? The very fact that Jesus could still walk is amazing. When Pilate says, behold, what does the word behold mean? Look, open your eyes. Look at this guy. Behold the man. What does he look like? When you picture Jesus coming out, what does he look like? He is a blood mess. Is that what somebody said? And instead of having any sense of remorse, any sense of satisfaction, any sense of that's enough, what's the Jews' first reaction? Kill him. And don't just kill him. Don't just take him back there and cut his head off. We want the most vicious. We want the most disgraceful death possible. And that's what crucifixion was. We're not going to get through all of these slides, obviously. Jesus endured an embittered, determined, and calloused enemy. They were not going to stop. They did not care that Pilate thought that what he had done was enough. They were going to continue. And even when he said, behold your king, they were not going to allow that to take place. And they even said, we have no king. That's sort of what their ancestors did in the Old Testament, wasn't it? Give us a king. So, wait a minute, you have a king. No, we want a king. They had a king, but they in essence said, we don't have a king. And here they are again saying, we don't have any king but Caesar. Jesus endured the shame of the cross. They made him bear his own cross. Amazing, the idea that he could even carry it any distance. But I want you to think about how cruel that crucifixion was. And in verses 19 and 20, it says that many passed by. This was not in some remote location. This was right there so that everybody, again, the idea of a spectacle, this was right there so that everybody could see him. Jesus endured these executioners who were only concerned about themselves, trying to get his clothes, gambling for his clothes. But little did these guys know that they were fulfilling prophecy all along. Isn't that amazing? That these guys whose whole intent was to create torture and death were step by step fulfilling detailed prophecies that God had made. And yet here is Jesus, patiently, humbly, lovingly and willingly enduring this. He did not react. Pilate says, "Where are you from?" He didn't answer. When you look at John chapter 19, how many red letters, words of Jesus, how many red letters? Jesus is about ready to be put to death. How much was he saying? Not much. Jesus willingly went to the cross, and as we've already said, he was only there 6 hours. We say only because for the Romans that was not a very long time. But it says that Jesus yielded up his spirit. It's almost another act of his own will, and that he willingly gave himself for us. When we partake of the Lord's Supper this morning, as a part of our worship, I would encourage you to read John chapter 19. And I would encourage you to think about yourself being right there. Remember that when Peter denied Jesus and the rooster crowed, Jesus looked over at Peter when that was happening. They were within eyeshot of each other. Imagine this morning as we partake of the Lord's Supper that while Jesus is being scourged and hung on the cross, that he's looking at you and he's saying, "I'm doing this, I'm enduring this for you." Thank you all for your good attention this morning.